Hi, and welcome to Grant Thornton's Risk and Regulation Unraveled podcast. This is our monthly review of developments in the world of financial services regulation. My name is David Moy, and I'm joined as ever by my colleague Ben Farmer. Say hello, Ben.
Hello, everyone.
And for those that are joining us for the first time, we take a ramble around emerging news on the FS regulatory front, reviewing what the regulator's been up to and developments that might impact the industry. And I think we are going to start by, well, quite a familiar little ramble down to Consumer Duty Corner. So we're recording this in early March, and we are just in receipt of some feedback from the FCA. So they have produced in late February a thematic feedback. It's entitled Consumer Duty Implementation, Good Practice and Areas for Improvement. And with the subtitle of what firms are doing well and what they could do better. So a lot of meat in there, I think. Ben, have you had a chance to look through it? I have as well. What's your takeaway? Well, I mean, what are they attempting to accomplish with this, do you think?
Well, so I think ever since the Consumer Duty came in, as is always the way with anything like this that's sort of principles-based, the industry has just been consistently crying out of, tell us what this means in practice. Don't just give us the principles. What do you actually want us to do? And I think this is a step very much towards that with these sort of list of examples of good practice areas and less good practice areas that the FCA has observed in its thematic work, is giving firms more of a clear steer on here are the sorts of actions we'd like you to take and the sorts of actions we very much want you to avoid, and bringing that to life with some kind of real world examples, which is very useful. The structure of the article itself is quite interesting as well. So as you'd expect, there's a section for each of the four outcomes under the duty. So products and services, price and value, consumer understanding and consumer support. Always a risk starting to list those so that you might forget one of them halfway through, but I think I've got away with it today.
You did. Nobody noticed any hesitation.
And then the bit that's particularly interesting is that there are actually a couple of extra sections that are not those outcomes that the FCA has added, which perhaps gives us a bit of a clue as to where their current interest and focus and priorities might lie. So one of those is on culture, governance and monitoring, which perhaps isn't that surprising or unexpected in many ways. It perhaps seems obvious there'd be a bit of a focus on that area or those areas, because those are actually in many ways three overlapping quite different areas that they've grouped together.
Yes, it's quite a lot to aggregate under one subtitle, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I guess you could perhaps describe it as stuff that boards should have a finger in. Perhaps what that bit.
I like that
bit. Clearly, it's not just the boards. And then there's also, despite it not being a specific outcome under the duty, there's a whole section for consumers in vulnerable circumstances, which is interesting, because in the original sort of CP and policy statements on this, that was kind of spread across the four outcomes, but definitely felt like it was more heavily concentrated in the consumer support and understanding outcomes, didn't it? Whereas now that's kind of grown and become its own standalone thing within this article.
That's interesting. Yes, that is interesting. So I mean, in many respects, it sort of takes the form of a lot of other feedback publications the FCA produces. It sets out good practices and, well, not bad practices, I think they call them improvement areas.
Some of them are definitely bad practices.
Exactly. So under each of these subheadings, we have a list of what the FCA considers to be good practices and a list of areas for improvement. It's obviously, for many of our audience, you'll be wanting to read this document at length, and we can strongly recommend that. I guess my question to you, Ben, is any highlights or lowlights that you've drawn out from actually looking at the specific examples that are set out?
Yeah, I think there's a few. I think in general terms, data still seems to be a struggle in terms of having enough of it, being able to actually do something sensible with it once you've got it. And the sort of holistic piece of actually trying to link up information and data between different teams, different IT systems, make sure that something relevant that one bit of the business knows gets shared with the rest of the business.
Yeah,
that's sort of comes up under all of these headings to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah, I noticed that. As a good practice was developing new data and metrics to better understand customer outcomes. And then as an area for improvement was basically just repackaging existing MI. So the strong indication is, or strong expectation there is that additional MI is going to be required or is expected to monitor Consumer Duty compliance.
Yeah, exactly. Another one under the sort of culture and governance areas for improvement was firms who wait to see if the FCA will intervene to address an issue rather than tackling it themselves. Which, given some of the other industry developments, some of the ones we talked about last month, some of the ones we're going to talk about probably a bit later on in this podcast, is quite pertinent at the moment.
We might have a real-time example to talk to a bit later on, but anyway, go on.
Inevitably, under vulnerable customers, there's always some poor soul. Obviously, all the feedback is anonymous, let's make that very clear, but there's always someone who ends up being the bad practice example. One that really did leap out was firms asking consumers to identify themselves as vulnerable and then unnecessarily requesting evidence of this. And then furthermore, on top of that, some firms apparently have suggested to customers that if you are vulnerable, it might mean they might not be able to provide you with a product or service, which clearly it's sort of the opposite of the financial inclusion objective that the FCA is driving out here.
Exactly, you're supposed to consider how your services can be enhanced or developed in order to facilitate vulnerable customers as opposed to locking them out. I thought that section was interesting. They actually quote, so rather than sort of firm specific stuff, they actually quote some sector level information. So they call out portfolio managers, 49% of whom say they have no vulnerable customers, and stockbrokers, who 69% of whom say they have no vulnerable customers. And the FCA say, well, based on our research, if 50% of all retail customers are going to be vulnerable at some point. So essentially, we're not sure we believe that these organisations are really identifying vulnerability appropriately. And they are pointing the finger at portfolio managers, I guess wealth managers within that, and stockbrokers for potentially not thinking about this as well as they should. But I think there's some good practice. I mean, we can highlight various items here, but that vulnerable customer section, they do talk about organizations that when a customer agent is dealing with someone who's vulnerable, then basically the productivity timer or whatever standards apply to any ordinary interaction are basically turned off. So they're making it very clear that more time can be spent with a particular customer. I think that's quite a good practice. I was a bit more dubious about the example they gave about, as a good example of elderly people using selfies to do the personal sort of verification piece. I don't know. I mean, it's sort of Instagranny and Instagrandad maybe was what crossed my mind there. But maybe that generation is more into selfies than I gave them credit.
I suppose if you're trying to do some form of ID verification, you're probably going to have them all up there than trying to get them to install a two-factor authentication app.
Yes, I
struggle with those. So
that is absolutely right. Yes, trying to remember 57 passwords. You're absolutely right. I'm sure I'm doing the Instagranny generation a disservice by suggesting they wouldn't be using selfies.
What was the other one on the poor practice list? Just assuming everyone elderly is vulnerable and can't work any tech.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So the reverse of not having any vulnerable customers was some firms have decided that all their customers are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that the FCA don't really believe that either. That suggests you are not taking the question seriously.
If you're over 65, you must be vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah.
Age old, if everyone's vulnerable, no one's vulnerable sort of dilemma.
So you said, they've got split out sections around culture, governance and monitoring and vulnerable customers. But they've also have picked out the familiar outcome areas. So products and services, price and value, etc. Have you got any takeaways from any highlights, lowlights from that feedback?
Yeah, there's a few. I thought it was interesting in the products and services section. Well, the good practice examples they pulled out was firms who are identifying products and services that are only available to customers through limited sales channels and making the product available more widely where they meet the needs of a broader range of their customer base. That's a nice kind of synergy between actually there's a commercial benefit there as well as the customer benefit. Perhaps helps offset some of the things that are said elsewhere in this that are perhaps not quite so balanced in that regard. Interesting as well that they put this under the areas for improvement route, but there's the age-old restatement of the dilemma that firms are responsible only for their own activities and do not need to oversee the action of other firms in the distribution chain. which is then immediately followed by the sentence, however in some situations, yes, first do need to consider actions by other parties. For example, you need to be, if you're selling through a distributor, you need to monitor the products and its distribution over time. Yeah. So you don't have to police other firms, except for when you do.
Yeah, exactly. But you have to regularly monitor how your distributor is selling your product. Yeah, yeah. I know it's but I know, you know, I guess the implication there, though, and I guess we know this from other things that have been said about the consumer duty is you are not responsible for your distributor. But if you find out that your distributor is not behaving in a way that is appropriate, you know, around how your product is being distributed, then the onus is on you and an organization, a manufacturer, to take some action about that, potentially, you know, cutting the distributor out altogether. So you're not responsible, but you are responsible for taking some action if there is detriment being caused by one of your distributors. So that's an interesting area, and it's obviously one of the most significant areas. The number one area for improvement they list in that section, you say, is basically inadequate information sharing between manufacturers and distributors in both directions. So clearly what the industry has done so far across different sectors, you know, the FCA is signalling that that's not yet enough and more will be required. But price and value, I found it quite interesting. They talk about, as do the rules themselves, of course, that the fair value is more than just about price. And then they give nine examples of good practice. And eight of those are the firm reduced fees, the firm cut its fees. I misspoke. Two of those nine, actually, the firm added extra benefits to the product. So,
and in one case,
without increasing fees. So that accounted for eight of them. The ninth example was that the firm actually just stopped selling a product because they decided it couldn't offer fair value. And I just find that interesting that none of the examples were, let's say, you know, the firm had undertaken a high quality analysis and, you know, fully justified the existing fee or potentially even a higher fee. Because obviously, you know, that's what many firms, you know, aspire to do. They feel their pricing is justified and they would like this assessment, to be able to demonstrate why it is a fair value. But those aren't the examples of good practice that the FCA decided to call out. Having said that, the improvement areas in that area, I think it's often the case with these market feedback things that is the improvement areas maybe tell you more about what you should not be doing and thinking. So the improvement areas for price and value include things like, you know, firms that are relying on the price of competing offerings to justify fair value, i.e., you know, we cost the same as everyone else. That's clearly not a good approach. And potentially also not thinking about how the value aligns to the actual remuneration you're receiving. So that's the kind of, you know, is it disproportionate remuneration for the value that's being provided? So that doing that thinking. And also going back to the distribution point we mentioned under products and services, but not understanding how other fees in the distribution chain might be affecting whether or not the end customer is obtaining fair value, because that's really the test here. It's not just have I provided fair value for my bit of the service, but ultimately is the end customer getting fair value out of the distribution chain that I've assembled. So there was good content there for sure. The last couple of areas, which are a bit thinner, I think, in terms of feedback, and maybe actually on consumer support, I think that's probably the thinnest area of feedback, but they've got this whole section on vulnerable customers, so maybe that's where you need to think of those two as in combination. They give examples, for instance, like consumer understanding of insurance companies putting up front, actually, as you start the application process online, what the material exclusions are in the policy, so rather than tucking those away, you know, seven pages into the application process, they put those up front, and I think that's quite a good approach to have. I did raise an eyebrow. One of the examples is around a funeral plan company's approach to outcomes testing. You're probably thinking,
there's a tasteless joke about customer service surveys, but I won't make that.
Yeah, no, I think it was taking the concept of consumer, not just the dead person, but sort of the next of kin and the wider experience there. Yes, I mean, it's obviously a must read, isn't it, Ben?
Yes,
100%. You can't ignore this. You need to think about it in terms of your application to your own respective business models, clearly. But there are some clear enough steers in this around areas where firms are not potentially doing as much as they should. Whilst we're still in Consumer Duty Corner, because I think it's pretty clear it's being wrapped up under the consumer duty as sort of a philosophical justification for it. There's been quite a lot going on in the gap insurance market, isn't there? Or rather, maybe not a lot going on actually at this point in the gap insurance market. Well, do you want to talk about what the FCA has done there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when we talked about motor finance last month, I ended that chat with saying, I wonder if gap might be next.
You did.
And about 2 days after we recorded that, but annoyingly before we published it, the FCA published their press release on gap insurance. So just for those finance insurance nerds and aren't up to speed, gap insurance, basically if you buy a car on finance, if it gets written off too early in the term, you can potentially be in a place where the amount of the write-off value that your car insurer gives you might not be enough to pay off the outstanding loan. So gap insurance basically is insurance for that gap. The FCA for a while now has had a bit of a suspicion that this is not a product that provides as much value to customers as it would like to see. In particular, for as long as it's been collecting the GI value measures, which is some data it gets insurance firms to report to it on certain products, one of those products being gap, on a range of metrics that lets the FCA assess the performance of these products, it's been sending fairly clear smoke signals to the industry of basically, we don't think gap is providing enough value, sort it out, or we will come in and sort you out. Particular concerns they've highlighted being that only 6% of the total amount customers pay in premiums for gap insurance is then paid out in claims. Just by way of comparison, that figure for motor insurance is 65%. The FCA also claims to have seen some examples of firms paying 70% of premiums as commission to third parties involved in the sale of gap policies. And the FCA clearly hasn't yet seen the change it wanted to see in this market, so it's now started taking rather more direct action. So in early February, it put out a press release announcing that several providers had agreed to pause sales until they could demonstrate improvements to the level of value being offered. I suspect they have agreed to do this in much the same way that if David produced a large knife from under the table now, I might agree to hand him the contents of my wallet.
These
are positioned as voluntary, but having seen examples of the types of letters FCA's used in similar occasions in the past, they're not normally very voluntary, are they, David?
Voluntary in name only, and that's fair enough. I think this is obviously a focus area, so this is not a time to try and fight back, I would suggest.
So these firms, it was just several providers, was all the FCA said in that press release, and it said that they between them accounted for 80% of the gap insurance market, and they basically agreed that they wouldn't be selling any new gap insurance policies effectively until the FCA has agreed with them that their product governance regimes are strong enough, that the product itself has had whatever changes it needs in terms of pricing, distribution channels, claims performance, etc., that the FCA is satisfied it offers an improved level of value, and therefore the FCA will agree to it being sold again. So that sort of took 80% of the market capacity off the board at a stroke, which was clearly a fairly sizable intervention and potentially interesting given the FCA's competition objectives. And then since then, I've not yet seen an official announcement from the FCA, but it's been reported in various places that the FCA has now required all of the remaining gap insurance providers to also pause sales. I think in Car Dealer magazine, they carried a quote from an FCA spokesman saying, following our agreement with the largest gap providers last month, we have sent further requests to the remaining providers to pause sales of gap insurance. Gap insurance can provide a useful service to customers, but in its current form, it does not offer fair value, and we want to see improvements. So the FCA has said that they don't want to ban gap insurance, but currently no one is allowed to sell it, which does feel quite a lot like a ban to me.
Yeah, well... Yes. Oh, it was interesting. Two things crossed my mind is if I'd been one of the 20% that was initially allowed to continue selling it, but I knew I knew 80% of the market, just being told to stop, I might have had a kind of risk appetite discussion with my board about whether or not we continue selling it. So I'm not surprised the other 20% have also been told to stand down. But yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I it's not providing value, but I guess if I have a new car, I don't have gap insurance, I potentially could suffer detriment if I am one of the few people that actually claim, because I can't get this insurance at this point. So I suppose the interesting case in point is, you know, how long this ban remains, and what does the market look like afterwards? Even are participants going to come back after this ban or not? I guess we've got no way of knowing, have we?
Not firm dates. Again, actually, that same FCA quote I was speaking to earlier, I didn't quite finish it, did say we're working closely with gap insurers to resolve these issues as quickly as possible, right, so the customers can access fair value products that meet their needs. So it would appear the FCA do want it back on the market. They just, I think fundamentally, they just want a massive commission cut. Basically, I think they're, with 6% going out in claims payments or premiums, they are struggling to see where the other 94% is going. I do think it's interesting as well, reading around, as you'd expect, there's a lot of comment on this on LinkedIn. If, like me, you follow lots of insurance pods on there. But that there are kind of two distinct distribution channels for GAP with quite different remuneration structures, because obviously a lot of motor dealers will, as brokers, sell GAP to you at the same time they sell you the car, and at the same time they sell you the finance. But there's also a quite large sort of standalone online non-advised GAP distribution market, which people on LinkedIn are suggesting, I have not myself done any data crunching to validate this, but tends to operate on rather lower commission models. Certainly the one and only time I ever bought GAP, I did buy it standalone, and anecdotally that was a lot cheaper than the quotes I was offered by the leasing company, who also offered to sell me some GAP. So I think that side of the market is quite annoyed at being swept up in this.
So they
definitely view it as being first and foremost a commissions issue, and a commissions issue driven by a particular distribution chain.
Distribution model, interesting. I mean, well, it is a sizable intervention by any standards, so you know, between an entire product line being taken out across the industry. So it will be interesting to watch both in terms of what, how long that lasts, but also what changes are considered sufficient in order for the ban to be lifted. So it's an interesting case that it could exist, you know, could very well not be the last such intervention we see, which actually potentially segues onto the last item in the Consumer Duty corner. The FCA put out a news release that they have approached around 20, they say, of the largest financial advice firms, so these are wealth managers, IFA type businesses, and asked them for data. So it's a survey on charges for ongoing service. So I mean, a common model, a very common model for an IFA or wealth manager, financial advisor, wealth manager is a fee is charged for an ongoing review service in relation to a customer's financial situation. One of the concerns in that Consumer Duty feedback we started the podcast with is that they think there are examples where a fee is being charged for an ongoing service, and an ongoing service is not actually being provided. That ongoing service usually manifests in that sector as not an annual review. And they have now, the survey is now basically asking for data. So basically, it actually says, how many clients are on an agreement which says they are getting ongoing service? Then they asked, how many actually got that service in the last year? And then the third question, which is a bit of a trick question if you ask me, is of those who didn't get the service they paid for, how many got a refund?
Yes, that feels like an obvious bear trap of a question, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, depending on your answers to the first two questions, the third question is a potential problem. So anyway, I mean, this is not new as an area of concern. Like I say, it's in the CD feedback. It's also been in the in other market correspondence they produce, but it's clearly an indication that the FCA are lasering in on that particular issue of people paying for an ongoing service and not really getting it. So what's this space for potential changes / refunds that might flow from that?
Seems to be a bit of a theme emerging here with anything fair value-ish from SC, isn't it? That they ask what review did you did, then they ask what did you do differently as a result. And anyone who says, oh, actually, we decided it was fine, we didn't need any changes, that the FCA seems to have a starting assumption across the board that that's the wrong answer. So
Yeah. This is a great example of that. Yeah, absolutely. It's probably not so much that that some people didn't get the service that they might have expected. So what did you do as a result of that? Mr. Regulated firm. Okay. All right. That's enough for Consumer Duty Corner. I'm sure we'll be visiting again frequently in future podcasts. Changing pace dramatically, so we'll just sort of run through of other developments. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge, as you might expect. One of those developments, and very, very different to anything consumer duty related. And I think actually if you look at the conclusions specifically being reached by the FCA in this case, you'll see just how contrasting it is from a consumer duty board. So because this was a wholesale data market study, which has been ongoing for a while, and we've basically had the latest report on that. So this is the wholesale data that is used by investment managers, brokers, market participants. So definitely not retail investors, although theoretically they could be at the end of a chain here. But this is market data, pricing information from exchanges. This is benchmarks. This is credit ratings produced by credit rating agencies. And this was a market study to look at the economics of that marketplace and potentially determine if there were inefficiencies. And initially, the conclusion is that, well, on the good side, the firms operating in the wholesale markets are able to get the data they need, is of sufficient quality, but they're almost or certainly paying higher prices than they might otherwise do due to poor competition. So, competition factors the market study talks about are, very, very small number of providers, say maybe three, depending on the kind of data area we're talking about, very large, very high barriers to entry. You can't just step in and become do credit ratings for a huge number of debt instruments, for instance. So very large barriers to entry. And these providers make big profits. They talk about, over 60% profit margins in some cases. So it's obviously very profitable for them, which is a potential indicator that there's market inefficiencies. But whereas, you apply that to the gap market and you get what you were talking about earlier, you end up with a product ban. In this case, of course, we're not talking about consumers, retail investors, albeit you may find them at the end of the investment chain as a client of the investment manager or a client of a broker potentially. But what the market study has gone on to say that due to other factors, they are suggesting that no action be taken. And they talk about the high level of regulatory change. They talk about the international nature of these markets. I mean, that is a decent point. It's difficult to deal with some of these big data providers just in the UK, given they've got an international footprint. And also, interestingly, it talks about the potential for unintended consequences in a market which, other than price, customers are getting more or less what they need. So the market study basically concludes we're not going to refer this to the Competition and Markets Authority. We are not going to take any fundamental interventions. We might look for opportunities to tweak some rules here or there, but basically it's not our job to regulate prices in this sector or try and encourage reduction in prices, and we're not going to. And that's obviously a very different conclusion than would be reached if this was a sort of retail financial services.
A lot of retail firms are still clinging on to the idea that it's not the FCA's job to set prices, but I'm afraid it is now. But it is the FCA's job to regulate them.
Regulate them, yeah. That ship has definitely sailed. You're absolutely right. But for wholesale markets, it is a different ball game, and the wholesale data market study kind of spells that out effectively. The big conclusion from that review is there's not much to see here. Nothing dramatic is going to follow from that market study. Maybe a bit more interesting, although one would hope it would only ever affect a few firms, is the consultation paper on changes to the FCA's enforcement guide. Ben, you've been looking at that.
I have. So this is CP 24.2, for those who want to go and look it up and have a read of it. Our Enforcement Guide and Publicising Enforcement Investigations, a New Approach. So the FCA has basically been doing a whole review of the Enforcement Guide, or EG chapter of the handbook, and there's a lot of stuff that's not really attracting much comment. They're basically stripping out a load of content that they don't feel is relevant anymore, or there are bits that they think sit better somewhere else in the handbook, so they're going to move them, and that sort of thing. But the big focal point that has attracted a lot of attention and comment is that the FCA wants to be moving to take on what it calls a more streamlined portfolio of cases which are aligned to its strategic objectives. It wants to close those that aren't going anywhere more quickly, and it wants to publicly announce investigations, including sometimes naming the firm under investigation much earlier than it does, because at the moment, basically, apart from in very exceptional circumstances, there will be no public mention of any FCA investigation until it's concluded and the firm has been served with an enforcement
notice. You're right. It's usually confidential before that point.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas now the FCA say that in future we want to proactively publish more information about our enforcement investigations, including their opening and progress. This includes publishing the identity of the subject of the investigation if we assess that it is in the public interest to do so, and if there are no compelling legal or other reasons not to. It will also include publishing updates on our investigations and announcing that we have closed cases where our investigations have not led to regulatory or other action. So it's probably important to set out very early on here that this is only investigations of firms that the FCA intends to be publicly identifying them wherever it is investigating individuals, for example, individual senior managers. Currently, no plans to publicise that until final notice, as is the current approach. The FCA has rightly identified that there's a whole range of GDPR and other legal considerations there that makes that not ideal. But it's interesting, they talk about they'll announce it where it's in the public interest. The consultation paper contains a sort of draft public interest framework setting out the sorts of factors that the FCA will consider when making these decisions about whether or not to identify a firm. Particularly in terms of things that might make it more likely to identify them will be where it feels this will enable the interests of potentially affected customers or consumers or investors to be protected, where it will help our investigation, for example, by encouraging potential witnesses or whistleblowers to come forward, and addressing public concern or speculation, providing reassurance that we're taking action, that sort of thing. Interesting, actually, there seems to be, it says the FCA talking about this, quite a lot of focus on the sort of encouraging witnesses and whistleblowers element. I think some people even pose questions to them about, are they going to enter into US style sort of whistleblower incentivization schemes where basically grass a firm up, get cash, to which the FCA has basically said, we're not going to rule that out, but it's, I don't think that's a specific proposal they're taking forward at this stage. They've also set out some of the things that might suggest them to be less likely to make a public announcement, being the conduct of our investigation or an investigation by another regulatory body, the interests of consumers, or actually this is interesting, they might not announce it if they think that doing so would be a threat to the stability of the UK financial system or our ability to otherwise carry out our statutory functions. I suppose that one's interesting. That almost leads you open to, well, if you're one of the strategically important PRA pillar one banks, you've probably got better odds of not getting your investigations publicised than some others, which
I mean that's
interesting from an equity perspective.
If you're just a large listed business, actually, from a market stability point of view, some organisations at the bigger end of scale might have that public interest argument for not disclosing. This is fascinating. I mean, I read this with interest. It seems to me that the sort of the carrot, and they did talk about this actually in the consultation paper, but the carrot here is it might incentivize firms to settle more quickly or potentially cooperate. I mean, I don't know, it doesn't call out level of cooperation as a factor in whether or not to make public, but I do wonder about that. The longer your name is out there, the more harm that's done to you. So you might be incentivized as an organization to settle as quickly as possible.
If you think sort of, okay, we'll agree to the PBR with the scope that goes much wider than we want, but it means the FCA put out an announcement today saying we've closed the investigation without taking action, rather than leaving this out there for 6 months.
Quite.
Interesting on that as well, actually. This will be a little bit retrospective, so any current investigations that are already ongoing whenever this new policy is introduced. They will be subject to this new regime. So I wonder if there might be some firms currently somewhere in the process sort of thinking, right, what can we do to escape this before all of this becomes live?
Well, yeah, and you're right. Obviously, this is a consultation, so we're not at the final rules point of view. And I can only imagine as consultations go, this will receive a lot of feedback. And in small things as well, down in the detail, it talks about the FCA will notify a firm that we're about to, well, it says, where possible, we will notify a firm that we're about to make it public, an investigation public, but with not more than 24 hours notice of that. So, you know, good luck with that. if you're trying to respond to lots of
PR and marketing teams probably suddenly need to get much more familiar with the role of the FCA than they perhaps traditionally had to be.
Yes. And it's, I don't know how this will play. I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, the consultation paper does cite other regulators in other jurisdictions as well as in the UK that are much more open around enforcement areas. It calls out Ofcom and Ofgem in the UK as an examples as well. Although you know, I guess their markets are quite different. You've got a handful of essentially near monopoly providers. So
you know, Ofgem, an investigation about 8 people, doesn't it? So if it just says we're investigating someone, you can figure it out by process of elimination.
That's true. And also the harm to their business is probably going to be limited by, you know, various sticky factors that mean that all the customers can't disappear overnight. Whereas in FS firms, I think there are situations where there could be very, very more significant impacts from an announcement of this kind. I'd also wonder whether, you know, does it put the FCA on the spot, as in if they make an announcement about an enforcement investigation, and does it make it harder for them from a PR point of view to turn around later on and say, okay, it was a waste of time. No, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you know, we've decided there's nothing to see. Having publicised it, I don't know whether that changes the dynamic. It's certainly a very interesting consultation. In a previous podcast, quite recently actually, we talked about the consultation the PRA are doing around their enforcement guide, their version of this enforcement guide, and this is not in it.
I thought it was interesting, actually, that the FCA have made a point of saying we have discussed this with the PRA and they've not raised any concerns in this, but this is very much the FCA's proposal. It's not something the PRA seem to be keen to follow them on.
No, quite. I mean, the big thing in the PRA consultation, which we talked about, was like an early account scheme, so ability to sell quickly. This is nowhere to be seen in there. This is fascinating. I mean, Consumer Duty obviously occupies a lot of these podcasts, but this is again, hopefully there are a very small number of firms that find themselves in this position, but for those firms, this is a really, really fascinating area where how practice evolves, how the rules evolve, but also how practice evolves will be incredibly important and interesting. So watch this space. Whilst talking about enforcement, very quick one. There's one notable enforcement fine this month, although I think that the learnings from it are probably limited. This is one of the directors of LCF. So this is the mini bond mis-selling issue that obviously spawned the Gloucester report and huge amounts of pain and suffering and gnashing of teeth, including I think some of the FCA executive directors getting their bonuses reduced and things. So one of the directors of the company that managed to achieve all that has been fined and banned from undertaking work in financial services for life. I think that's right, isn't it? This was the SMF that was responsible for compliance.
Yes.
And I think the wording of the final notice is they recklessly signed off thousands of financial promotions, including many that suggested that mini bonds were, or implied that the mini bonds were regulated by the FCA. You know, subject to other consumer protections, which they were not.
Failed to obtain evidence of the claims being made, allowed promotions that gave a misleading impression that the mini bonds were regulated by the FCA. I think this is the real kicker, continued to approve promotions even when they became aware of inaccurate claims. Yeah. I mean, that's all. I've not done that much financial promotions sign-off work, but that's not at the complex end of it, those particular failings, is it?
It doesn't seem like a particular grey area case, does it? I suppose one interesting note, normally when we talk about these individual fines and bans, we caveat it by saying that, although it's in the public domain now, the individual in question is appealing to the RDC, the decision. That's not happening in this case. And I was musing that someone with this on their CV was probably not going to be high on the list of potential recruits.
I think to be fair, I don't imagine anyone with a senior role at LCF on their recent CV is going to be posting about that one too much at the interview stage when they're looking for new opportunities, are they?
No. So that's noteworthy, but without being particularly surprising. Two or three other quick bits and bobs I'll just run through. There's a speech that the SEA chair Ashley Older gave to the EU on open regulators and open markets. It's a fairly diplomatic speech. Suggesting strongly that there was no point for the UK diverging from EU regulation where it made no sense, where there's sort of a wider international framework, etc. It talks about not diverging without very good reason. Change for change's sake would not be a positive. The need for ongoing cooperation, etc. So it's not depending on your position on the Brexit debate, it's a fairly conciliatory speech, and I think reflective of the. Of current,
we want to hang on to our equivalency decisions if we can, please, or we want to get some.
Well, exactly, get some. I think that that ship has sailed probably, but it might be worth a quick look if anyone's interested in that area of EU cooperation in particular. We had final rules or near final rules PS324 from the PRA on Solvency II. So this is the first batch of Solvency II reforms. We talked about it in consultation paper. This is the least exciting piece because it's really focusing on reporting and disclosure. Mainly one for the actuaries, I think, from a content point of view. Definitely one for the actuaries, actually, because they presented in the consultation paper some sort of detailed reporting templates, and the PRA says they got 900 points of detailed feedback on the template reports.
that's what happened when you consult with actuaries.
Thank you to the actuarial profession. The final rules mirror the consultation. I think they got rid of three extra forms. They made a decision, reporting timescales would actually remain the same rather than be sort of reduced, so then closed the reporting timeframes up, or they'd not accelerated those. It's not that big a deal. You can see that from the cost benefit analysis. It estimates that the changes from this rule update will save the average insurance company £62,000 a year. So the much more interesting, much more significant changes, obviously still being consulted on, but that will actually change the reserving and capital positions of insurers. So we'll come onto that later in the year when they're available. And the final thing I'd say, in terms of other bits and bobs, is the PRA has issued its sector letters, so insurance, deposit takers, international banks, etc., for the different areas that it supervises. You'll see financial resilience, operational resilience, climate change risk in there. No dramatic surprises, but I suppose the one quick takeaway I'll give the audience is that the insurance sector letter is much longer than the ones going to the banks. It throws in things like readiness for regulatory change around Solvency II, growth plans, expansion of the sector, interplay between insurers, reinsurers and other capital providers. So there's basically quite a lot of additional focus areas that are being called out in the insurance letter, from which I would deduce that their supervisory activity around insurers is likely to be more obvious this coming year than maybe it is for the banks. So certainly the PRA seem to be saying they've got a bigger agenda for firms in that sector.
Yeah, I think there's some fairly hefty insurance stress testing being worked up at the moment as well, isn't there?
Between the gap ban and the PRA's the PRA's sector letter, insurers are going to be keeping themselves busy, I would suggest. So that's all for this month. I'd like to thank everyone that's joined us for this month's podcast. We will be back next month with another roundup of events. If you wish to
look into any of the areas we've discussed today, please do go to the Grant Thornton website. We have material on covering all of these matters and more. Without more ado, I'll say goodbye and look forward to speaking to you next month.